Well, can I first of all thank the organisers and also congratulate the organisers for this important and so far successful event, and also thank my audience for your participation late on a Friday afternoon when it is so sunny outside. Let us hope some good comes of our sacrifice, is all I can say. I won't actually be talking about very much about freedom fighters this afternoon, but certainly if you invite me back, I can give you some ideas about that subject. My topic and my agenda for this afternoon is really concentrated on two issues, and I've tried to keep this as brief as possible, bearing in mind the concentration of this event. The first, I will use a concept called militant democracy, and I want to explore this concept and see how it can be used, whether it can be used. And in fact, I will try and apply the concept to some United Kingdom counter-terrorism measures, which are called proscription and the incitement of terrorism. Jerome mentioned this offence in his presentation. So my first point is militant democracy. What does this require, or what might it require in the context of terrorism speech? And my first point is this has quite a long history. I can find, for example, in the 1930s, when the threatening speech was seen to be from fascist parties. Publications at that time urging states, including a number of states in Central Europe, to be more militant in terms of confronting the Nazis and the extremists at that time. One of the prominent theorists being Karl Lowenstein. This was carried on and lessons learned from the experience of the of wartime, carried on with theorists such as Clinton Rossiter, who talked about a constitutional dictatorship transforming your constitution into a tough, resilient and militant organisation which resists extremism. There was some revival of this idea. Another frightening person, Mrs. Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister of the UK, who had to confront terrorism from Irish Republicans. And she also was not one to back down. And I think, although she didn't use the words militant democracy, she did confront terrorism speech. And she came out with this quotation, that the time has come to consider the power of the media to influence the progress of terrorism. There is an urgent need to starve the terrorist of the oxygen of publicity. And measures were taken in the United Kingdom at that time to ban, in certain respects, spokespersons for extremist Northern Ireland groups. I do say that this concept can be taken too far. I do get worried when people start talking about a zone of anomy where law does not hold sway. I think that would be rather too militant for my taste. Or to construct, as Gunter Jacobs constructed, an enemy criminal law in which we treat our political opponents as if they were military forces. So there are dangers in militant democracy. And so what I try to construct is another version of militant democracy, which I call smart militant democracy. And so what is smart militant democracy? Well, I think I've tried to invest it with a number of features. One, it recognises the permanence of the threat and the need for sustainability. And so I think this rules out some excesses. It rules out the idea that you can have a war on terror, or you can ignore your normal values in your society. So I think sustainability is important. I think accommodation of individual rights, that militant democracy is not a departure from individual rights, but must accommodate individual rights, is an element of smartness. And that it must be part of a strategy against the threat. It must be strategic and not what might be called the politics of the last atrocity, simply responding in a very emotional way to crisis, but responding in a strategic way. As far as the United Kingdom is concerned, I'm not claiming that the United Kingdom is the smartest of the smart, but I think there are these features have been better adopted in recent times and do suggest that we might be able to claim that the United Kingdom is a smart militant democracy. I don't doubt it is militant. I think the big question is whether it is smart. But to give one example on the final point about being strategic, I think the United Kingdom has moved towards being strategic. The strategy against terrorism is well set out in a command paper, an official paper, which includes various strands of policy, and any action taken has to be justifiable under one of these strands of policy. So I think that is some improvement. I could talk about a broad range of policies which have been adopted, but the two which I want to test against these precepts, they are both under a UK piece of legislation called the Terrorism Act 2006, and one is a measure to ban associations or to place a ban on groups. This is sometimes technically referred to as proscription in UK law. And the other, which I mentioned earlier and Jerome mentioned earlier, is about incitement offences, incitement in this case to terrorism rather than to religious hatred. But many of the same problems and issues arise again. So I want to talk about these examples. And so my first such example is about banning orders or proscription orders. And what I want to say here is there are two types of banning order under UK law. The first type has been around for a long time. It is a ban on organisations involved in terrorism. And that has not been very contentious. It has not been challenged because these are notoriously groups which conduct, encourage and organise violence. I don't think that is at the edge of legal debate. And I think that type of ban can be easily justifiable. I think the ban on organisations which encourage violence helps to support peaceful politics, both practically and symbolically. And it is also, I think, readily justifiable under the European Convention on Human Rights. Jerome also mentioned Article 17, which has been used in some cases. There's quite a number of cases which have considered these articles and the banning of organisations. I don't think I've got time to go through them. They do make some distinction between those groups which are involved in violence and those which are not, although latterly the European Court of Human Rights, which is forever changing its mind on issues, seems also to ban organisations which it simply views as undemocratic or hostile to rights. I should add that there are equally arguments against having bans, so let me just say that there are problems with this system. There is the unfairness of the process. It tends to be based on a minister's order. It is not a court order in the British system. You might say, well, if somebody is involved in violence, prosecute them for violence. And there are certainly many offences, of course, against violence. It sometimes gives these groups publicity, which may actually encourage support rather than discourage support. At a conference on free speech, you'd be disappointed if I didn't mention chilling effect. Somewhere, somehow, I'm sure there is a chilling effect. And the other common argument used is you can't trust the state in handling these matters. So I'm saying that for many years we've had laws against organisations which are engaged in violence. But what happened in 2006 is that we took powers, the UK took powers to ban organisations which glorified violence. It was not shown that they took part in the violence, but they glorified the violence. There were a number of reasons for this change. The first, it was a felt need to take action following the bombings in 2005 in London. It was also felt that this further step was required by the Council of Europe Convention on the Prevention of Terrorism, 2005, Article 5. And to back that up was also the UN Security Council resolution of 1624, also 2005, take measures against the advocacy of violence, is what that said. So the British government felt it had a number of reasons to take further action against those who incite violence, and therefore did so. According to, as I've mentioned, the Terrorism Act, this built on measures previously taken to say that if an organisation promotes, encourages terrorism, including the unlawful glorification of terrorism, then it can be banned, and membership of that group will be a criminal offence. So my question is this a smart thing to do? Is this smart militant democracy or stupid militant democracy? And I think by and large there are arguments either way, but as it turns out, it has been relatively smart. Let me give you my evidence. There are problems with this measure. Uncertain boundaries. Ascription of responsibility. Who is responsible for statements which glorify terrorism? Who is a member of a group? And is each member authorised to issue every statement? That can be very problematic in connection with small and rather fluid groups. It is again a legislative act, not a judicial act, and therefore there is a lack of due process. Those are worries. That's not very smart. On the other hand, these are the organisations which actually have been banned. And they largely all relate to just one organisation. They're actually all variants of this organisation. In the third box down, it is called Al-Muhajirun. And that is essentially the one group which has been banned. The other groups are viewed as allies or alternative names for Al-Muhajirun. And there are two further... one group suggests a degree of reticence and smart application, even if the provisions aren't so smart. I think further evidence of restraint has been that other candidates have so far been turned down for banning. The two prominent candidates which have been suggested to Her Majesty's government, often, I should add, by foreign governments such as Egypt or Saudi Arabia. So far, the government, the UK government, has resisted banning these groups, which are some of which are banned elsewhere in Europe, including in Germany. Reports have said the government shouldn't go further, although a recent report tackling extremism in the UK says that perhaps other measures could be taken. I conclude on this first example that there are some elements of smartness in this measure. There are few groups banned, there are no prosecutions, and what I conclude is that you could say this is a piece of expressive legislation dealing with offensive or dangerous expression. It meets expression with expression. It does not meet expression with acts, with prosecutions or bans. It amounts to a statement, and I think that is along the lines of an appropriate thing to do in this area. Let me move to the other example, more controversial. This is about making criminal offences regarding incitement, and my time is short, so I'll have to try and summarise this point. A new offence that applies to a statement likely to be understood as a direct or indirect encouragement or inducement to terrorism. And for the purposes of this section, indirect inducement encourages all of these types of activities. The word glorification appears quite a lot in these in this piece of legislation. But I think one, in the second last line, one point which is very important as a limitation is that we're looking for some kind of statement of glorification or encouragement which seeks emulation of what is being glorified. In other words, there is an element of some action will follow. It isn't an abstract statement. I think that's an important point. I won't go through the mens rea and so on of this, and I'll skip this point as well. I'll move on to my critique. I have about a minute left. Problems may be rather vague. When this was being debated, this provision, it was said, well, people like Nelson Mandela would be surely convicted under these provisions. How can we convict Saint Mandela? That would be a terrible thing to do. And more recent in history, this statement from Cherie Blair, the wife of the then Prime Minister, Tony Blair, who was Prime Minister in 2006, it was stated in Parliament that maybe she would or should be prosecuted under this offence. I'm a little doubtful. I'm not sure that the element of emulation is there. One other problem is that the speech offence is universal. So if you encourage terrorism in Libya against Colonel Gaddafi, that can also be an offence. Or you encourage terrorism against Saddam Hussein. I leave an open question whether this breaches Article 10. The British courts have said it does not, but there has been no judgment by the European Court itself. Are other offences sufficient? And just again to raise a quick point that Jerome mentioned, Abu Hamza is an interesting case. He was not prosecuted under this provision. He was prosecuted for an offence of 1861 called solicitation of murder. So you could say, why do we need this offence? It was possible to prosecute under existing offences. I leave some of these other points. An important point, I think, is that final point about community stigmatisation. Certain communities seem more suspect and at risk than other communities. I need to wind up, so just to mention that there are some smart elements, which are that there have been very few prosecutions for this offence. And so I think, again, it turns out, my same analysis applies as to the previous provision, it turns out to be a rather expressive act rather than an act of taking action. It is highly symbolic, which has sought to change behaviour, but without actually taking action against individuals. And by and large, I think it has had that effect. My conclusion is that it is, I think, justifiable to try and pursue the idea of smart, militant democracy. It is a difficult path to draw. And by and large, I generally favour the idea of meeting speech with speech. But may I finish on the final point, which is, if you want to know more, you have to buy my book. Thank you very much.